This is Latter Day Radio. I'm Greg Girard, and we're here on KLO 1430. Today, I'm with Jonathan Neville, author, retired attorney, and a lecturer. And I heard his lecture the first time at the Davis County Convention Hall when I went to the Firm Foundation Expo. And I think I'd like to take us back to the very beginning, Jonathan, and let's talk about your Road to Damascus experience. How did you become a Heartland Hopewell aficionado or fan or expert now? How did that start, and what brought you to the place you are currently on your own journey?
Well, I guess I could start by explaining how I got interested in this topic as a whole. When I was about 14 or 15, my family was in Greece, and we were visiting in Athens, and my father told us that when we were on the Acropolis, he pointed down to Mars Hill. We went down there, and he said, "This is where the Apostle Paul taught." And it was the first time in my life that I ever related the scriptures to the real world.
Wow.
And I had never really even paid much attention to it. And so I read the account of Paul on Mars Hill. And from then on, I started reading the scriptures and wondering where all the different events took place. And since then, I've been to Israel several times and throughout Paul's travels and so on. And with the Book of Mormon, it was similar. I, as a kid in seminary, of course, I was kind of taught the idea that the Book of Mormon took place in all of the Americas or in Central America. It was a little vague. When I went to BYU, I had a class from John Sorensen, and later I went to my first job was as a clerk to the Supreme Court down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there was an archaeologist there who was doing a peer review of John's book, Ancient Setting for mm-hmm. the Book of Mormon. And so, and he made me a copy, and I kind of went through it with him. And I was convinced by John Sorensen's book that the Book of Mormon took place in Central America for many years, for decades, actually.
And so are probably a majority of Latter-day Saints at this point.
Exactly, because that's what the people at BYU have been teaching, and as well as in the Church Educational System, CES. And so probably for 30 years, I went along with that. I bought all the books that I could find that were published on the topic. Even when I was on my mission in France, I bought a book about the Mayans in French to mm-hmm. tell the French people about. I did firesides about the Book of Mormon in Central America. And then I guess it was about 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, I went to an event by Wayne May, and he presented this idea of the North American setting.
Which probably set you back and said, "Whoa, I haven't heard this before."
Exactly. Yeah, it was all new to me.
I had the same experience. I haven't seen Wayne May, but I've seen his YouTube videos, and piqued my interest.
Same happened with me. And so I started exploring it, doing some due diligence. I didn't really have a lot of time to spend on it at that point because I was still working full time. And then about maybe 5 years ago, something like that, I went to another conference, and this was up in Midway, and it was Rod Meldrum put it on, and he was talking more about this North American setting. One of the fellows there, one of the presenters, talked about the voyage across the Atlantic of a ship called the Phoenicia, mm-hmm. which was very interesting to me because I had never made sense of Lehi crossing the Pacific Ocean.
That's a long way to go.
It's a long way, and as far as I could find, there was no historical comparables. But this one, crossing the Atlantic, made a lot of sense to me. And so afterwards, I spent some time talking with him, and I began exploring it a little more. Well, at the same time, I was working on a series of legal thrillers, and one of them involved the Native Americans kind of reclaiming their tribal lands.
So a book you were reading or a book you were writing?
A book I was writing.
Oh, fantastic.
And so I was doing research for it.
We need to compare some notes.
Okay.
Because I wrote a book as well. Time to plug my book? No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I was doing my research for this book about how could the Native Americans reclaim their land because of the U.S. government having violated the treaties and so on. And I wanted to talk to Rod a little more about that because he seemed to know about the Native Americans. And so I went and met with him, and he told me in order to really understand what he was saying, I should go on a tour to Ohio. And I thought, you know, I've traveled all over the world. I've been to every continent, to all these ancient sites, and I'd never been to Ohio, really.
Ohio? Does that sound like a place where you'd find the Sphinx or right. pyramids or...
Yeah, exactly. So I thought my expectations are pretty low for Ohio. But I went on the tour with him and Wayne, and I was blown away by what I saw in the museums. Everything that the Book of Mormon talks about in terms of armaments and so on, you find right in these museums, state and federal museums in the Midwest. And so it totally reversed my train of thought.
It's not like there were people lined up to get into these museums. I imagine it wasn't like going to the Smithsonian in Washington, right?
Not exactly. You're right. They typically are, some of them are fairly small. The State Museum in Ohio is a pretty well-established one, but it has a lot of other things besides archaeology. So I came away from that trip puzzled, because for three decades or more of my life, I had been persuaded that the Book of Mormon took place in Central America. So I started researching it again and reevaluating my assumptions, and I came to the conclusion that Central America just didn't fit for a lot of reasons. So the next question I had, I asked Rod, why do we even start looking in Central America? And he told me that it was because of some articles in the Times and Seasons that Joseph Smith wrote about the Book of Mormon, Zarahemla, Guatemala, and the ruins in Central America being built by the Nephites. Well, I looked into those articles, and the first thing I noticed is that they were all anonymous.
But they weren't necessarily written by Joseph Smith.
Exactly. And so I wanted to know who wrote them. And there had been an article published that did kind of a stellometry approach that indicated that there were three candidates to have written those articles. It was Joseph Smith, John Taylor, and Wilford Woodruff. And of those three, Joseph Smith was the closest, but even these anonymous articles were outliers. And that even piqued my interest more. I thought, why would they focus on those three men as the only possible authors of these articles? So I dug into the Times and Seasons, the church history at the time, and one of the first things I realized was Joseph Smith himself had written letters to the editor of the Times and Seasons to have them published. And this was in September of 1842, right when these anonymous articles were being published. And I thought, wait a minute, if he was the actual editor, why would he send letters to himself to be published? It didn't make sense. And then when I looked at it more closely, I realized that the letters that he sent in are now Doctrine and Covenants section 127 and 128 in our scriptures. And he sent those in because they were important. He wanted the saints to know them, but he was not the publisher. And so, and at this particular period of time, both Wilford Woodruff and John Taylor were also out sick.
So they weren't the authors either.
Yeah, well, they weren't there to publish it at least.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And then I looked into it some more, and it turned out there's another newspaper, a Mormon newspaper in Nauvoo, being published on the same printing press in the same printing shop called The Wasp. I had never even heard of The Wasp. So I looked into that, and that was published by Joseph Smith's brother, William Smith. And as I started comparing the editorial content from the two newspapers, there was a lot of crossover between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up writing an entire book about this, actually three books about it, because to get into all the detail. Because as soon as I realized Joseph was not actually editing the newspaper, he was listed at the end of the newspaper as editor, publisher, and printer. Or what it said was, the Times and Seasons is edited, published, and printed by Joseph Smith. Nobody thought Joseph Smith was down in the print shop running the presses, so he obviously wasn't the actual printer.
Sort of like how we do today, published by the Corporation of the President.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I figured if he wasn't really the printer, then why do we assume he was actually the editor? And throughout his life, Joseph Smith was not known as a literary man. We have very few manuscripts in his handwriting. You can see them all on Joseph Smith papers. And it just didn't make sense that he would be actually editing other people's work when he had hardly time to write his own. So I ended up concluding that a man named Benjamin Winchester was the actual author of these articles. And that's a long explanation I don't have time to get into. But the point was that these articles did not originate with Joseph Smith. And therefore, it seemed to me that the entire premise for the Central American, Mesoamerican theory was flawed. It was based on a mistake in church history.
It was speculation by a man whom we really don't know.
We don't know much about Benjamin Winchester, for sure. But one thing we do know about him was that a month before he died, Joseph Smith said of Benjamin Winchester that he was rotten at heart and would injure the church as much as he could. And
that's not a very good thing to put on your resume.
Not exactly. No. And in my opinion, Winchester was successful in injuring the church significantly by promoting this whole Central American thing. So I went from that historical research. I faced a lot of opposition from the Mesoamerican advocates at BYU. They were critical of my findings. They didn't want me to publish about it, and they refused to put a lot of my materials in their publications. And so I thought, well, it's one thing to say Joseph Smith did not write about Central America, but it's another thing to figure out where the Book of Mormon actually did take place. And that's what led me to inquire more about the geography issues. Around this same time period, I came across a letter that Oliver Cowdery had written, which was designated as Letter 7. He wrote a series of 8 historical letters, or I call them the First Gospel Topics essays, and they were published in the Messenger and Advocate in Kirtland, Ohio, in 1834 and 1835. These letters are really fascinating because they were responding in part to anti-Mormon criticism. One of the biggest criticisms was that the Book of Mormon was fiction, that Joseph Smith copied it from another source.
Solomon Spaulding's manuscript or wherever it may have come from.
Right. And so as I started looking at how Oliver Cowdery refuted that argument, in Letter 7, he talks about certain facts that tie the Book of Mormon directly to North America. Specifically, he said it was a fact that the final battles of the Nephites and Jaredites took place at the Hill Cumorah in New York.
So, Jonathan, you're talking about Letter 7. How many letters were there in total?
There were 8 letters.
8 letters, and we have Letter 1 at the end of the Pearl of Great Price. It's a footnote. And I've read it many times. It's a wonderful explanation of the restoration from Oliver's point of view.
Exactly. Oliver Cowdery was writing a series of facts to refute all the rumors that had been circulated about Joseph Smith. And one of them was he explained in detail how John the Baptist came, how the baptism took place, and so forth. And that is in the Pearl of Great Price.
Well, we need to get back to that in the next segment. This is Latter-day Radio. We'll be back after these announcements.